Now at 6:30, Russell Davis continues his survey of the story of radio comedy by venturing into the 1950s, a period of great change.
Ladies and gentlemen, we present a radio program in English. From time to time, actors will be heard. The author has fled the country.
The curious start of an odd experiment. The program in English brings an echo of Gilly Potter, but you recognize the actors as belonging to a younger generation than that, a more worried generation too.
1954, a world overshadowed with doubts, fears, uncertainty. Of Indochina, the Suez, Cyprus, East and West German strikes, the H-bomb explosion, and yet to come, the unbelievable power of the cobalt bomb. But our own governors are not unaware of these dangers. At this moment, the House of Commons are debating serious matters.
Darling, they're ruining St. Martin's.
There are far too many darlings in Trafalgar Square.
We must get rid of these disgusting creatures. We must.
Well said.
Here, get some tea.
Well, was it a goon show or not? The goonologists are probably still debating the matter. The Starlings had the goon cast, but the sometimes serious satirical tone had more to do with the real-life preoccupations of scriptwriter Spike Milligan, who couldn't bear to see effort expended over the extermination of supposedly pestilential bird life when all around the political world seemed to be falling apart. The show got the goons, not for the first time, into trouble, and later we'll hear a little of what caused offence. But meanwhile, another of the problems involved in it was its experimental form. Listeners had already grown used to laughter and giggling from the audience and the performers as the oral washing line on which the goon show was hung. But here, the background was as bare and audienceless as a radio play. In the early 50s, as a matter of fact, a general disgust with audience shows was in the air. In his popular show, Just Fancy, Eric Barker was one of the ones to voice it.
Ladies and gentlemen, may we take this opportunity of welcoming you once more to this program. You see, no audience roar to persuade you that it's going to be really something. No orchestra, fashion, large lip and brass to make further conversation on your part impracticable. We just depend on your goodwill to get our message across. Of course, goodwill can be a two-edged sword. Occasionally, we hear the variety show that does not retain the goodwill with which it starts, so that the artist has to leap in and supply his own laugh.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Tommy Comfort Show! And here he is, the boy who can't go right, the guy England can do without, every woman's idea of what a man shouldn't be, the one and only Tommy Comfort!
Hello, boys and girls. Well, how are you? Everybody all right, eh? I'm so happy because I'm not mean, you know. Oh, no, I was watching my pipe cleaners last night. By the way, he's a very funny woman, the wife, you know. Writes poems as the wife. Yes, writes poems. Here's one. I love my hubby very much. He loves blanc mange and jelly. But I never give him rhubarb because he suffers with his headaches. By the way,
It seems there was a widespread feeling that now the war was receding into memory, stand-up comedy was trying too hard. The Stephen Potter-Joyce Grenfell gang thought so too, in their third programme expose, How to Broadcast.
Our next guest in Fits and Starts will be introduced to you by our old friend Bill Swinston, if I can get him out of the bass drum.
Bill? Hey, Bill, come over here!
Oh, me? I'm far from fit.
You'll feel all right when I tell you who our next guest is. Picture the Eiffel Tower.
Aye.
Picture a gay little cafe on the corner.
Aye, I feel better already. I'm feeling fit.
Yeah, the essence of that lovely city of laughter is the chicest little Parisian of them all.
Oh, la la, lead me to her, lead
okay.
me to...
Okay. Bill, this is Colette Mignon. Colette, this is Bill.
Hello, Bill.
Hello, Colette.
Where? Qu'est-ce que ça veut dire, where? What does it mean, where, Bill?
Well, it means why couldn't I keep my big mouth shut? Well, it means you're a bit of all right, Colette, and third okay.
I think you are. Who are you, Bill?
Well, I'm far from fit. Very funny.
No, it gets worse.
Well, I was walking along the street just now, and I saw a man I know. His name was Smithers Pomfret, and he was carrying a zither. Well, he was the third man I'd seen with a zither in a week. Oh, well, that goes better with film fans. He said, how about a quick cuppa? So, of course, I said, suits me to a T. Oh, that's what it says in the script. No wonder the scriptwriters are starving. Well, where was I? Oh, yes. I was having a cup of tea with a sailor.
And that failed gagster was Mr. Roy Plumley in his satirical days. Imitators and impersonators were still plying their specialized trade, and as usual, they're harder to judge, since their victims and targets are only dimly remembered. But there's no doubt, judging by the response, that a young variety bandbox recruit called Peter Sellers was getting it right.
This is David Southwood, and as usual, my seat is in the circle, but there's a little boy sitting next to me who keeps shouting. I say, Sonny, would you mind being quiet, please?
You're shouting, you are.
I beg your pardon. I'm Southwood, not Stoppy.
You may be Southwood, but you're still Stoppy. Here, can you play Knock Knock?
Yes, I can.
All right, Knock Knock.
Who's there?
Cohen.
Cohen? Cohen who?
Cohen, shut your big gulp.
It must have dawned on Peter Sellers after that reception that these infantile characters were worth sticking with. At the time he recorded that, the Goons were still an idea waiting to force its way into fulfilment. The material was already being stockpiled by Spike Milligan.
I used to work behind a bar in Westminster in London, and the chap who owned the pub, Jimmy Grafton, he was writing at the time odd scripts for a chap called Derek Roy, who was big shakes in those days, and I used to tell one or two jokes, and then bit by bit he said, do you know any jokes? I said, there's some more jokes. And then I ran out of the jokes. And he said, well, you don't know. I said, no, I can make some up, I suppose. So I started to make up jokes for Derek Roy through Jimmy Grafton. And bit by bit, I started writing scripts. And then I started to write way out things, which were constantly cut from the scripts. And I kept all these things on one side. And nobody ever used them, except when I met Peter Sellers. And then he laughed like mad at these jokes. I said, do you think they're funny? He said, yes. I thought that was praise enough at the time, because he was quite a big name in radio when that happened.
Milligan and Seacombe had met in the army in Italy. Milligan and Sellers were trying out material privately. And the fourth active goon was Michael Benteen.
We'd all known one another at the windmill. And we naturally gravitated. We got the same sense of humour, so we gravitated together. This we were called the Junior Crazy Gang. It shows you how long ago it was.
The goon voices came from all over. Eccles, largely from Walt Disney's Goofy. Blue Bottle from the kind of kiddywink we've already heard. Gritpipe Finn from the standard George Sanders character, and so on. But their collective name?
The origin of the goons was in the 30s. The Popeye cartoons had characters that were big and hairy. They had rather thin biceps and very fat forearms, rather like Popeye, same sort of drawing. And they were called goons. They lived on a goon island, I think. And they talked in soundtrack. They had a sort of... And that was the goon. They were great big hairy twits. Then later, during the war, when there were Allied prisoners of war in Germany, they referred to the German guards as the goons, because they were great big hairy brainless twits.
Finally accepted onto the airwaves in May 1951, over 2 years after they'd started pushing for a chance to appear together, they had to accept a billing as those crazy people. BBC senior management couldn't go along with this goon thing. In fact, at least one of them thought he was dealing with the Go On show. As far as we can tell from fragmentary glimpses of the first two series of Goons, Benteen was at least as prolific a supplier of ideas as Milligan. He certainly played one of the dominant character parts as Osric Pureheart, a mad inventor. Here he is in one of those rare and hairy-sounding shreds of early Goondom.
Now, gentlemen, this new excavator of mine will move 30 tons of earth in exactly 1 minute.
That's impossible.
That's impossible. No, no, no. I'll do it. I'll sign the fuel for the very, very exact second with my wristwatch. Ready? Go!
You know, Captain, that's sounding excavator I've ever heard.
Excavator? That was my wristwatch.
The Goons of 1952, and at last they were officially allowed the name they wanted in June of that year. It was still a magazine program rather than an interrupted narrative, so there was room for Harry Secombe to give them the operatic works. A real pagliaccio with sobs and not a giggle or a raspberry to be heard. Secombe was a busy man. He'd become one of the stream of young stars who rose simultaneously through the ranks of educating Archie.
Mr. Hattel Secombe, your trustworthy travelling salesman. Bringing you the new electric chimney sweeper. No more black hands, no more black faces, no more soot, and in many cases, no more chimney. When I finish cleaning your chimney, it will be so clean you'll be able to eat your breakfast in it.
But, Harold, your mouth and your hands, they're black.
My last client insisted I had breakfast in it. Silly fool. He got on the roof and lowered me down a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and then some bacon and egg.
Oh, no.
Well, then all I can say is you're wearing a very small yellow beret.
Yellow beret?
Yes, with bacon ear flaps.
Oh, fool, the absolute fool. Agatha, do you remember I was taking you out to lunch?
Yes, I read it.
Good. Well, I'll kneel down. You get a knife and fork. This is it.
Of all the nerve.
No, Agatha, please, please, don't catch me like that. I didn't mean it. Say something nice to me, Agatha. Say something, stand there, silent. Say something. I was ribbing you, Agatha. Please forgive me. Agatha, you can't leave me like this. Say something.
Bacon bombs.
Secombe with Archie and Hattie Jakes, later Witmar, and Max Bygraves, too. It may seem unlikely now, but Bygraves at the time was consorting with at least two goons, because he was also a star of Paradise Street. The common link between all three shows, Goons, Archie and Paradise Street, was the writer Eric Sykes, who worked on a similar wavelength to Milligan and his early partner Larry Stevens. In this sequence from Paradise Street, you'll hear a perfectly recognisable Bygraves, Hattie Jakes again, and a strangulated Milligan impersonating a policeman, with some very Milligan-esque lines. Maybe he collaborated on them.
It's 11 o'clock. Mr. Fussburton should be in bed now.
Where should you?
We must make no noise. Above all, I must dig silently.
How can you dig silently?
He's got a rubber shovel.
But how will you know when Mr. Frogburton's asleep?
I'll find out.
Yes?
Good night, Mr. Frogburton. Sleep well.
Good night.
But even if he's asleep, won't he hear you digging from his bedroom window?
I'm not going to dig from his bedroom window.
Your boots are making enough noise to waken the...
Don't say it. In any case, I'm wearing soft shoes.
Got your shovel?
Yes.
Well, do me a soft shoe shovel.
Mr. Frogburton's hardly likely to sleep while he's being interrupted at 5-minute intervals.
But, dear silver lady, how else will we know when he's asleep?
We'll put a ladder to his bedroom window and have a look.
That'll be a good idea.
Even better than a catchphrase in which the audience has to participate. I remember shouting, "Son," myself when Bygraves came to Blackpool about that time. There was a good deal of the goons' reversible logic at work in that material, and it was a form they were now on the way to perfecting. Michael Bentine had left the team in November 1952, but with Milligan now enjoying a greater confidence in himself as a performer, the three-man team was well able to carry on. By the fourth series, late in 1953, The Goon Show was sure enough of its storyline to carry a dramatic subtitle. The first, one of the long-lost Goon Shows, was called The Dreaded Piano Clubber.
Nobody about in the shop. Is there anybody in?
Yes, me.
Who are you?
Mr. Cran, I came in with you.
Splendid! Mr. Cran, it's only you and me.
Good, good, good. In any case, whoever works in this dreadful, filthy piano shop must be right off his head.
I wonder who he is.
Oh, good evening.
Good evening.
I will not... you want a bar, Shadow?
I'm looking for a criminal.
Oh, that's one mic I haven't got.
I wouldn't buy a piano with this hovel.
What?
I've kept
a hovel? My shop a hovel? Oh, no, my man. This is a very elegant shop, this is. Famous men come here, my man. Famous men. So, do you know who comes here?
No.
Monsieur Spall de Grine.
Is he famous?
No, but he comes here.
From the dreaded piano clubber, starting as they meant to go on, since pianos, clubs, and dreaded items featured largely in Spike Milligan's overheated imagination throughout the rest of the 50s. But the goons were an acquired taste, and listeners would only acquire it gradually. The real devotees, young people of, say, the Prince of Wales's age, or a bit older, were too young as yet to catch on. Joining Just Fancy in the no-audience movement in the early 50s were the Canadian pairing of Bernard Braden and Barbara Kelly. They'd started out uncertainly in British radio, making at first the big mistake of reproducing the formulae of Itmar in Leave Your Name and Number.
You realize, of course, that you're driving me into the arms of some rich, gorgeous dope of a girl.
Cooey! Mrs. Griffin.
Good morning, Griff.
Morning, Dax.
If we knew you were coming, we'd have cleaned the place up a bit.
Oh, that's all right, dear. I can clean round the dirt.
Good.
Oh, my feet are killing me. It's the new shoes.
Too small for you?
No, my feet are too big for them.
Oh, sure.
Just like me old man.
Your husband complains about his feet?
Everybody complains about his feet, dear. First thing he does when he comes home from the works is to take off his boots and put on the television. I don't know which bothers me most.
I take it then you have some fault to find with the television programs, Mrs. G.
Oh, it ain't the program so much. It's our machine. Something wrong with it.
Something wrong?
Yes. Half the time the bloke that comes on grinning and said, this here's the BBC television service, is on upside down.
Upside down?
Yes, because my old man's too stingy to take it to be mended. Instead, he's built a trapeze in the sitting room and hangs there by his knees. Well, let's get on with my work.
Yes, it seems a shame to get that nice new mop all dirty scrubbing our horrid old floor.
Does, doesn't it? Well, I'll leave it until next week, then, shall I?
Huh?
Cheery bye.
Cheery bye.
Miriam Carlin making the very best of a recycled Mrs. Mop. They had a Colonel Chutney character, too. But with Breakfast with Braden and later Bedtime with Braden, they settled down into an intimate, no-audience format, playing off the suavity of announcer Ronald Fletcher, as several later shows would do, and being cackled at, just to remind listeners that laughter was not actually forbidden, by the band.
You may have heard of our school, one of the finest centres of education in the North, Old St. Ingots and the Foundry. We of the staff were proud of everything in it, except... Well, we all knew that the most unpopular person in the school was the Latin master, Mr. Tuckhamper. How could he fail to see the intrigue that was rampant between myself and his bitterly pretty young wife, Gloria?
No, you're back, my dear.
Talk. Just as soon as I get in the door, don't you ever shut up.
Well,
I suppose you want to know where I've been, don't you? Well, I stopped into Gab at the lab with young Stinks, the handsome science master whom he has got all the girls for miles around in a whirl about him.
Yes, well...
Well, what? I don't know why you have to get so head up about every little thing I do. Oh, my head is spitting. I must have a migraine again.
Yes, dear, I'll fetch one for you. Dear me, Gloria's gone. Probably the bus ride back made her feel ill. Oh, yes, sick transit Gloria and the doorbell will ring.
It is I, sir, your pupil, young Pabulum.
Come in, Pabulum, come in. Time for our lesson.
Our last lesson, I'm afraid, Mr. Tuckhamper, sir. The headmaster's just declared you out of bounds.
So this is my reward for 15 years of continuous service at St. Ingots.
16 years, I believe, sir. You came here the year after I did.
So I did, yes.
Nobody cackled more loudly in that band than Charlie Katz. And years later, he earned his own show with his novelty sextet, where you could hear him cackling at himself. Bernard Braden credited the producer Pat Dixon with mobilizing Bedtime with Braden. And along with Dennis Mayne Wilson, Dixon had most to do with the promotion of the Goons from idea to reality. Producers are sometimes lucky. Shows fall into their laps, almost ready-made. Others have to carve a satisfying program shape out of the living manure. Dixon, anyway, seems to have had the knack of attracting programs that would, in the end, achieve a high-quality finish. One that gave him less trouble than most, I would imagine, since it was largely devised by Peter Ustinov with the help of Muir and Norden, and featured Ustinov and Peter Jones as most of the cast of characters, was In All Directions. This was a show where you were more thankful than usual for the absence of an audience. Those half-mumbled subtleties, those little tones of voice, would have been lost on a stage.
Good morning. I saw your board outside saying the house is for sale. Are you the owner?
Yeah. No, you see, we're the agents. We believe in the personal contact, and we're always on the premises. Dudley.
Hello, yes.
Man, are you interested in the house?
No. Yes. Good morning, Mr.
Good morning.
What's the name?
Grosvenor.
Dudley Grosvenor.
My brother.
Yes, I was rather interested in the house. It's a very old house, isn't it? What period would you say?
Well,
what periods are there?
I've got my period chart. I've got the newspaper book.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, this George.
Yes, George. It's George. George the Fifth. There's George the Fifth.
Oh, yes.
Yes, just about there.
Could I see you around?
Now, I'm going to take you. Now, open in the door. Now, they're on the entrance hall. I want to. Now, I'm not going to say any more. Now, I want to see the first impression of it. Yes. Right here. What do you notice?
The smell?
You've
got a sense of humour.
I can see that.
You've got a sense of smell.
Well,
I really went to the floor.
No, you're warm. You're getting warm, undeniable.
The wall.
You're warmer. You're hot.
Oh, the ceiling.
First time. It never failed. Isn't it lovely? Look, there's a piece of it near your foot there. You can examine in detail.
Where does this door here lead to?
Those are the usual offices. There's nothing unusual about those offices.
Yes. What about the lease, gentlemen?
The lease is a 2 3/4 lease spread over 3 1/4 year.
And split. And you're a party war which you're entirely responsible for.
And it protects you against yourself.
That is a good thing.
I think you are your worst enemy.
Well, I'll just, if you don't mind, I'll just run upstairs and have a look over the...
Don't run. Don't.
Be advised.
Here we go.
This, well,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dudley.
Yes?
Run for it.
Full of depth, throwaways, and overlapping dialogue, Ustinov and Jones in All Directions as Murray and Dudley, with the bewildered client played, as you may have guessed, by Frank Muir himself. Muir and Norden, having got through the pain barrier that afflicts writers after several series of the same show, were now approaching the maturity of Take It From Here. With Jimmy Edwards, Dick Bentley, and at this stage Joy Nichols, they had hit upon the glums.
Ron, you can't take your dad on our honeymoon. Well, you know him and his remarks. Oh, Ron.
Oh, now, don't cry, beloved.
No.
Look, we needn't all stay at the same hotel. We'll book a double room at one hotel and a single room at another.
Well, that might be possible.
Of course, Ed. Then Dad and I could meet you on the beach up quick. Don't cry, beloved. You know it only makes me cry.
Oh, hello. What's this, a meeting of the Johnny Ray fan club?
The Glums on their way in 1954. Peter Sellers in that year was still doing character voices for Raise a Laugh, but his goon range in the meantime had almost completely crystallised. The Goons, in fact, were soon well enough established to offer hospitality to the running characters of a previous comedy era, the one from which they themselves had recently escaped.
Meet the Black Knight, sir. The Colonel is coming. Tottenham 3, Arsenal 2, snow on high ground.
The Colonel? Oh, chain the brandy to the wall. I know his sort.
A draught of port. I don't mind if I do.
By the great leather putties of Jemadar Goldstein. Colonel Chinstrap, it's you, sir.
Yes, sir. Colonel Chinstrap is always me.
What a fortunate coincidence for you both.
Well, if you insist, Dennis, just to show to
bed. Yes.
Enough?
Just a spot more.
Yes, yes.
Cheers. Cheers.
Have another?
Just a small one, please. Yes.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Spot more?
Oh, no, no. I think it's about time you had one. Just a minute, my boy.
Quiet yourself!
Blasted goldfish.
Jack Train's Colonel Chinstrap, unexpectedly bobbing up above the whiskey line again in the fully developed Goon Show. But in the still formative year of 54, with the Starlings, as we said, they nearly parted company with the BBC. Like Tony Hancock, whose swift rise we'll be following next time, Spike Milligan was not a man to draw a neat distinction between his comic self and his real-life concerns. So there was a lot of anger in his work. And the same anti-authoritarian feelings that produced characters like the military coward Bloodnock could be turned on other authorities too. The BBC was one, and no doubt would have been, even if Milligan hadn't already felt that the corporation was working him too hard and unsympathetically. At all events, a scene in which a very Richard Dimbleby-like commentator described a ceremonial appearance by the Duchess Boyle de Spudswell, a lady clearly not unrelated to the occupants of Buckingham Palace, did not please the powers that were. They'd hardly cleared up after the coronation yet, but they all got over it, and comedy did live to fight another day. We'll see you then.
And now she reaches the great gold and bronze microphone to make her declaration. But first, the master of the rolls and leather goods pledges his allegiance, also the quanta donorum. So let us listen to it. To be having trouble with the great microphone of state. The same great microphone used ever since 1672, hand-beaten and foot-slapped gold and silver, surmounted by two Burmese cherubs, and fashioned by the great sculptor Ben Venuto Cellini and his brother Fred.
My lord, ladies, and gentlemen, please silence.
With that great, dignified ringing across the great square, she steps up to the great microphone.
That was The Starlings. That was. And I'm asked to say that any resemblance to a Goon Show is due to the laxity of the producer, Peter Eaton. Good night.
Russell Davis wrote and presented Radio Fun, and his producer is Neil Cargill. As we heard, next week they'll be tracing the rise of Tony Hancock, in addition to meeting the Huggetts, and sampling Life with the Lions. We heard next week they'll be tracing the rise of Tony Hancock, in addition to meeting the Huggetts, and sampling Life with the Lions.